Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Welcome to another week of the Inside Lacrosse D1 Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Flynn, joined as always by IL publisher Terry Foy. Thanks for downloading. If you like what you hear, please tell a friend. Last week was one of our best weeks ever, and it's all thanks to you. Tell a friend. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, leave a rating and a comment, and hit us up on Twitter at @D_Fly and at Terrence Foy. If you'd like to share a thought, a comment, or a question, go ahead and email us at dflynn@insidelacrosse.com and at tfoy@insidelacrosse.com. On today's show, we'll be discussing the sad death of Georgetown player Eddie Blatz. Major League Lacrosse gets its season underway. We'll talk about the inaugural Lacrosse Industry Summit scheduled for May 27th in Philadelphia. We'll look at Anish Shroff's love of Game of Thrones. I take a jab at Albany's resume. And we'll also look at the shocking scores and surprising outcomes of last week's game, as well as an in-depth look at the week ahead. Terry, let's go. Terry, we start today's show on a somber note. After a great weekend of lacrosse, we found out on Sunday that Georgetown University player Eddie Blatz passed away on late Saturday night, early Sunday morning. And he's the second men's college lacrosse player to die this month after Cabrini's Jake Durkin died earlier.
I mean, there's not a lot to say. Certainly express our condolences, you know, mine personally, I'm sure I speak for you. Inside Lacrosse is an organization, you know, first to the Blatz family, to the Georgetown men's lacrosse team and you know, surrounding program and the athletic department and university as a whole, as those concentric circles get wider. You realize, I think, that, you know, for example, I'll put it this way. There was a stream of condolences and a stream of acknowledgments, hopes that Eddie rest in peace and that his family find comfort. And one that struck me was Bernie Merrill retweeting Riley O'Connor. And the reason it struck me is because Riley O'Connor is an alum. Brody Merrill is an alum who coached Riley O'Connor in high school. And so it what that did is it kind of showed me the extension beyond which, you know, beyond just the guys that are in that locker room right now who are impacted by a situation like this. And, you know, there isn't a whole lot of solace to be taken from a situation like this. But I did have a few conversations toward the end of 2015 that are a little bit helpful. Speaking with members of the Huber family and the Darcy family about everything that comes along, I suppose, with the certainly the loss of a child, the loss of a brother, you know, particularly a young man whose life comes to an end too early. And I think that there's some small consolation to be taken from the fact that when you're a part of a very vibrant, close-knit community like a lacrosse team, so often the support structure is a little bit more expansive and a little bit more impactful than a lot of other families that have to go through this in a much more isolated type of way. And so I think that in general, you know, there's obviously a lot of sadness and a lot of tragedy that surround these types of situations, but, you know, hopefully a little bit more hopefulness than first appears on the surface.
Yeah, there's not much that can be said. It's always tough. You know, I think about my two kids and what that would be. I can't even imagine. I can't. And it's just compounding on what's been a pretty tough season down in D.C. for the Hoyas. And there's really not much else we can say about it. Kind of has got us in a little bit of a funk today.
A little bit.
Yeah. Terry's got his Tottenham Hotspurs.
That's right.
Jersey on.
Got to support the squad.
I got something that is a little bit of cheerful news for Georgetown. And, you know, one of our interns this summer is a current player on the team. Joe Bucci is one of the captains. And I'd be interested to get his take on this. but he's had a great senior year. He's a fifth-year senior, had 5 goals the other night against UVA, and he's also scored some of their 5 biggest games. I think he's scored the first game, or first goal of the game, yeah, from his midfield spot. He's really put together a great season, and I'm looking forward to him joining our team this summer.
And he's not the only Hoya who's going to be joining our team this summer.
Yeah, we're announcing Caroline Darney is going to be joining our team.
Full time.
She had a lot on the line on Saturday afternoon. She's a UVA undergrad, and she's working on her master's degree in Georgetown Sports Management Program. Same program as Joe, their classmates. Again, Joe's a fifth-year senior, and he's graduated, and he's taking his grad work. She'll be joining our staff, too. So it's a little bit of a more positive news and note. Terry, there was some other some exciting new stuff happened this weekend as well, the opening weekend of the Major League Lacrosse season, and almost all the teams were in play.
Right, when you have 9 teams, not everybody can play.
Denver didn't play, but there were no real surprises. The champion New York Lizards beat the Rattlers. Bayhawks beat the Atlanta Blaze in their first ever game, 16-13. What was the crowd like there?
Well, talking to Quint, who was calling the game, he was pretty fired up, thought that it was a great turnout, really lively. And I think that it reaffirmed something that we already know, something that's going to come into play this weekend, which is that Kennesaw, Georgia, Fifth Third Bank Stadium is an awesome venue. It's a great place to watch lacrosse, but really it's a great place to watch anything, it would appear. Very intimate, very cool, I like the fact that it's square. There's no track, there's no separation really between the benches and the crowd. It's very low, but it's also it's a bowl. I've always been a huge proponent of having seating on all 4 sides, which is pretty uncommon in lacrosse. So it was a very energetic environment, it sounds like.
In a couple of the other games, Charlotte beat Boston, and the Ohio Machine beat Florida in the other 2 games.
Yeah, so just wanted to give special mention. We're just moved off of that Bayhawks win a little bit too quickly. Two of the most impressive performances of the weekend belong to Bayhawk attackman / midfielder Matt Danowski, who finished with 9 points, and Nico Amato had the best goaltending performance of the weekend, making his kind of debut in the wake of the Tyler Fiorito trade in the offseason.
Terry, let's talk about a new event. Give our listeners a little sneak preview for something that we're going to announce this week on InsideLacrosse.com. The inaugural Lacrosse Industry Summit.
Yeah, thanks for that setup there, Dan. Really appreciate it.
Well, we've been working on this for quite some time. It will take place on Friday, May 27th in Philadelphia at the Lowe's Hotel, which is downtown, next to the convention center where U.S. Lacrosse has had some of its conventions. And at those conventions, sort of what spurred this idea on is that you see a lot of, it's like a trade show. The coaches are there, whether it's the IWLCA convention that's in Florida, the IMLCA coaches convention here, or the U.S. Lacrosse. It's a lot about X's and O's, rules. It's for officials. It's for coaches. But there's not an opportunity for people within the sport, the business of lacrosse, to ever really get together and share ideas and best practices, look at trends, what's new, what's coming. And this will be an opportunity for that to happen.
That's the goal, and that's the iteration of the idea. Over the last year or so since I've become publisher of Inside Lacrosse, it's a conversation that I've had numerous times. Just the lack of an opportunity, the lack of a forum, the lack of a venue. There's no lacrosse chamber of commerce. There's not really even a lacrosse industry coalition or cohort. So as you mentioned, the opportunity to come together, share thoughts, share ideas, and try to learn from each other and learn from folks who are outside of the sport. So, as we announce this, that'll be the key component is, we've lined up a kind of marquee, so to speak, that I'm pretty proud of in terms of folks both kind of on the, I don't want to say fringe or outskirts because it almost sounds like demeaning, but folks that have 1 foot in the lacrosse industry and certainly a lot of influence and work outside of the lacrosse industry, who will be able to provide some external perspective as well as some internal perspective, and then some other folks that work with entities like the PGA and Major League Soccer who can shed some light on how they as an organization have attacked some of the issues that we feel like lacrosse is facing right now.
Yeah, it's really an impressive panel, and I'm looking forward to learning from those. In addition, there'll be some smaller breakout sessions that will be very topical that you can pick and choose which ones you want to go here depending on what background or what part of the industry you're from. As well as I think that a cool idea is we'll create some space and some block out some time for people in specific category to get together and to in one room to talk, which very there's rare occasions for this to happen. So, you know, retailers can get together, the media, and there'll be a host or a moderator that'll sort of help guide the conversation. But I think it's a cool opportunity for people to get together and share their thoughts. And while it's open to all professionals from the lacrosse business community, the goal of the summit will be a gathering of the industry's most influential people to share their insights and spark discussions that will hopefully shape the future of the sport.
Yeah, and I think that in that way, it has kind of a cool dual value. And I hope that for a lot of folks who have gone to the Final Four for 10, 20, 30 years, this gives another anchor to championship weekend, an opportunity to, you know, both network and feel like the weekend got kicked off on the right foot because you can walk away at 5 o'clock on Friday feeling like you've already got something done. You've already justified your trip to Philadelphia aside from watching, you know, 5 great games or, you know, 10 great games if you're going to the 8 great games if you're going to the women's games as well. But I also think that, you know, one thing that is at the opposite end of the spectrum of what you mentioned, Dan, is that it's not simply a goal. The goal of this event is not simply catering to current lacrosse industry professionals, but also to prospective folks that want to work in the lacrosse industry. And we think, you know, I think back to the spring of 2007 when I really wanted to work in lacrosse and didn't have a job. And, you know, an opportunity to come to something like this and being able to shake somebody's hand that, you know, might have a fit for me, an opening for me, would have been a really cool thing that I would have appreciated the opportunity to do. So, you know, we're getting going, as it were, in terms of pushing the Lacrosse Industry Summit's message and making sure that anybody that might be interested in attending knows that it exists and how they can attend if they so choose.
Yeah, so the look for an announcement later this week on InsideLacrosse.com. And there's more information at insidethelacrosse.com/summit. All right, Terry, moving on to the games. And what a weekend it was. There were some amazing upsets, some shocking scores, and some games that played out exactly the way we thought they would, but maybe in a different fashion than we would have imagined. Our first game is North Carolina defeated Notre Dame, 17-15, and our Peter Cotrompas was down there covering the game for Inside Lacrosse.
It's a little bit cloudier now, but a lot earlier it was really sunny as the North Carolina Tar Heels stunned the Notre Dame Fighting Irish, the top team in the country, 17-15, powered by a 7-goal fourth-quarter outburst that took everybody by surprise. Trailing 14-9 at the end of the third quarter, many might have thought that the Fighting Irish would have just kept going along and finished the game off to earn the top seed in the ACC tournament coming up next week. However, hitting the post 3 times on separate occasions played to North Carolina's favor and bought time and also provided energy for the offense to churn and keep churning until the final whistle blew. In the end, Steve Pontrello, a senior graduating, scored 4 goals and 2 assists and was matched by Luke Goldstock with his 4 goals and 2 assists to power the Carolina offense, earning a co-championship title for the regular season as well as top seed in next week's ACC tournament.
So you heard Peter there on the epic Inside Lacrosse game day recap video. And there are a couple of different places to start, but the one that I want to sink my teeth into is I'm continually amazed, you know, with these top 10 teams that play each other every year, how much continuity there is year to year to the way that the games unfold. So certainly the starkest example of this is Duke's decade-long dominance over Virginia. The fact is that I won't pick Virginia until, yeah, I'm going to be late when it comes to picking Virginia over Duke as opposed to being early. And one of the things over the last couple of seasons that has emerged as a trend to me is I'm just continually impressed by how well North Carolina plays Notre Dame, particularly in years when Notre Dame comes into that game ranked higher or perceived to be better than them. And it felt that way in the middle of the second quarter. Obviously, Notre Dame was able to create some separation heading into the fourth quarter, at which point you kind of expect that defense that's routinely the best or among the top 3 to 5 best in the country to put the clamps down on Carolina. They weren't able to do it. And to me, you know, this result impacts or reflects one thing about Carolina more than anything else, and that is the athletic prowess of Steve Pontrello and the craftiness of Luke Goldstock, two attackmen who each finished with 4 goals and 2 assists. I think that there was an understanding heading into this season that with Steve Pontrello moving to attack his natural position after having played midfield for 3 years, if North Carolina was going to be successful, he was going to have to bring a dodging dynamic that we had not seen from him through his time in Chapel Hill prior to that. And I thought that this was a game and particularly a defensive matchup in which his ability to meet that level of production certainly suggested that. And then Luke Goldstock, who had a breakout sophomore season last year, you know, has been a little bit less consistent this year. To be able to match that production with 6 points was really impressive. And, you know, Notre Dame is a team that famously isn't matchup conscious, I think is the right way. It's the way that I've liked to say it over the last several years. But it doesn't matter because they've got a couple of guys. It's not just Matt Landis. If you get Eddie Glazner or Garrett Eppel on you, like, it's not going to be an easier day than it is if you're, you know, matched up against Matt Landis, particularly when, you know, you've got John Sexton sliding to you or whatever the case may be. And I thought that those two attacking did a really nice job for Carolina to, you know, kind of score goals in the flow of the game as opposed to doing so in a weird manufactured kind of way. And I think that ultimately that's what put me in a position where after this, you know, 7-goal fourth quarter and they take a 17-15 lead inside of 2 minutes to go, there was a stoppage and I still had confidence that Notre Dame was going to win. You know, they've come back from worse deficits in the past, including last year in South Bend against North Carolina. Those last 90 seconds, you know, maybe 105 seconds or so, just went like that. It felt like the game went from, oh, wow, Notre Dame's got some work to do. Like, they very much on the brink of losing this to being over almost immediately. It was a kind of a weird feeling or a weird phenomenon, weird way to end the game.
Yeah, in Quint's weekly story on Mondays on InsideLacrosse.com, he mentioned that Notre Dame never took a timeout during the entire 7-goal run, which is baffles me a little bit because that's what they're for. Momentum and stop a run like that. But yeah, it was I was shocked by that score when I saw it. I wasn't able to watch the game, and I never in a million years thought someone would score 17 goals on Notre Dame's defense.
2 points I want to make. The first is in his recap of Loyalist 12-6-1 over Army, which we'll talk to in greater detail later on. Jeff Shan led with the idea that Loyola is peaking at the right time. I don't disagree that Loyola is peaking at the right time. However, I disagree with the general perception that this is the right time to peak, depending on what your goals and expectations are. If your goals and expectations are to make the NCAA tournament, then yes, I will say the middle of April is when you want to peak. If your goal is to win the national championship, I think it's actually pretty productive to lose in the middle of April. Certainly better than losing at the end of April or at the beginning of May. And I feel like if I were Notre Dame's coaching staff, there's some sense of relief to know that your team is going to be very, very focused, probably very angry coming off of a 17-15 loss to North Carolina. And if I were North Carolina, you know, I've said in many instances, in many forums, in many venues, that I think, you know, one of the kind of systematic cracks in the foundation that has led to their inability to get back to the Final Four in recent years has been that they aren't able to play a game the week between the ACC tournament and the first round of the NCAA tournament. You know, I would be concerned that a win over Notre Dame, you can argue that it goes one of two ways. It's momentum building, and on the flip side, it could be a little bit of fool's gold, and I would be concerned that it would shade the latter, particularly if you don't know how focused you're going to be able to keep your team in practice this week as you prepare for the ACC tournament and then a bye week just beyond that.
Okay, Notre Dame's SID, John Heisler, sends out some very well-written
Sunday brunch.
Sunday brunch is what he calls it, yeah, sure. And he makes some great points of how the world, lacrosse world, sort of changed in the course of a few hours in Chapelville. You know, as of noon Saturday, North Carolina's name had been absent in the bracketology as like an at-large team. A couple hours later, they're the number one seed in the ACC tournament. And, you know, moving back up the our rankings, huge RPI win for them. And meanwhile, Notre Dame, which looked like they had it sort of wrapped up, is now in the 2-3 game, has to play Duke, played them very well just a few weeks ago in South Bend. The ACC tournament is going to be very interesting.
Well, I feel like a lot of people have forgotten that the ACC tournament is for an automatic qualifier in 2016. If they don't add a sixth team heading into 2017, this will be the last year for which that's true. But if you remember in 2014, they had six teams, which is what it takes to get an AQ. And you get a two-year grace period after one of your teams leaves, as long as you stay above four. And that's exactly where they are. So in that way, you go back to Virginia's loss to Duke and say, man, they really did miss an opportunity. But I still do believe, and we can talk about this when we get to the week ahead, that Virginia is alive. And obviously any of the four ACC teams that are in the mix right now as well are too.
Terry, you have an interesting note about what this game may have done for the All-America race.
Yeah, so I've been on the Shane Doss bandwagon for a while in terms of first-team All-American goalie. That comes along with the Kelly Award almost always as well. And I feel like even though I don't think that he played poorly, only making 12 saves and giving up 17 goals impacts your save percentage overall, that I think that race is a little bit more wide open. And I would actually say that Brown's Jack Kelly is in pole position right now, which yields some interesting stuff. I mean, I would think that Dylan Malloy would be in the mix for attackman of the year, if not the favorite, at this point as well. So the idea of Brown taking home two of the big four position awards, you know, is probably something that not a lot of people would have expected at the beginning of the season. Just something to keep an eye on.
Terry moves into our broadcast observation of the week. The guys calling the Notre Dame North Carolina game.
Anish Shroff and Paul Carterra.
Yeah. And I didn't realize Anish was such a dedicated, diehard Game of Thrones fan.
It was very clear to me that he had one eye on the game and one eye on Sunday night at 9 p.m.
Yeah, and his Twitter feed will back you up on that one.
Absolutely.
He got into a very humorous, fun conversation with Dan Abern, Kyle Devitt, and Paul Carcaterra about Game of Thrones and its links to lacrosse teams and which families from Game of Thrones or dynasties would be considered applicable to the current NCAA teams. And I was talking to Dan Abern at lunch about it, and he was coming down some of it. Quite funny. It's worth the time. If you like that show and you like college lacrosse, go back and look at it.
Well, you've confused our audience because you referred to this as the broadcast observation of the week, which you actually addressed the component side of this. We combined for this week. Very special for our listeners.
Very special edition. The Twitter follower of the week.
Exactly right. Combined.
Broadcast observation.
So the broadcast observation of the week is that I think Anish might have been a little bit distracted by the impending season premiere of season 6 of Game of Thrones, and as a result, set himself up for one of the best foibles of a broadcast so far this year. That being that with 5 seconds to go in the first quarter, after a Notre Dame goal, saying that the upcoming faceoff was, I can't remember exactly what he said, meaningless. I think it was meaningless. Meanwhile, Notre Dame wins it backwards. Short stick D midi, Drew Shantz comes up with the ground ball and flings it at the goal. It's worth noting that in the last rule cycle, I believe it was the 2014 rule cycle, but it may have been 2012, the NCAA changed their rules for buzzer beaters. It used to be that the ball had to clear the goal line before the buzzer sounded. Now it is that the ball only has to leave the player's stick before the buzzer sounds. It's disputable whether or not it was outside of Shantz's stick by the time the buzzer sounded, because the face-off scrum, etc., was about 5 seconds long. Coach Bresci for North Carolina was of the opinion that there was actually not one-to-one synchronization of the clock and the buzzer, But in any case, it clearly we wouldn't have talked about this for this long if the ball didn't go in. It did. A 50-yard goal. It was awesome. It was on a bounce. It totally handcuffed the Carolina goaltender and gave Notre Dame some nice momentum heading into the second quarter as what, you know, a lead had been extended by two goals over the last 5 seconds of the period. But it also led to an interesting conversation about whether or not there should be some sort of light-up mechanism around the cage when the buzzer sounds, as there is in college basketball with lights behind the backboard, or NBA basketball as well, when the shot clock goes off. I think that would be a little costly and a little bit impractical, but it would be very cool.
You know, you'd have to, it'd be hard to run a cable, so you'd have to do it remotely. And, yeah, that would be, I don't see how they're setting that up. Especially at, like, you know, some of the D3 schools.
Right.
Like but, yeah, there was a lot of Game of Thrones chatter between those guys, and Dan jumped in, and Dan's our Twitter follow of the week. He's at Dan Aburn 2423, at Dan Aburn 2423. And, you know, we had one tweet where Sergio Perkovic had a great game. And one of his tweets is a live look at Sergio Perkovic, and it's just one of the dragons from Game of Thrones just blowing fire.
Yeah.
Good stuff, Dan.
Serge had four goals. Yeah. Aburn's really strong with his gifts. So if you like following Twitter accounts that compare points to gifts or relate points to gifts, he's right in your wheelhouse.
He also is, his Snapchat game is pretty strong too. We let him manage the IL Snapchat account on occasion when he's doing some game coverage, and he brings it
more than on occasion and more than allowed. I mean, he's basically the steward of our Snapchat account at this point.
I didn't want to put it like that.
That's a generational thing. I feel like his being the youngest member of our staff has a lot to do with that.
Yeah, no, he's good at it though, and brings some entertaining content to it. So give Dan a check,
and check out Inside Lax on Snapchat as well. I can't imagine that there's that much. In the Venn diagram, I don't think there's that much crossover between Snapchat users and Inside Lacrosse podcast listeners. How do you feel about that? If you're listening to this podcast and you use Snapchat, either tweet at us or send us an email, because I would love to know a little bit more about what percentage of our listeners use Snapchat.
I would too. I don't have a lot to say on Snapchat, but I enjoy looking at other people's stuff, and I didn't get it at first. I mean, years ago, when, you know, it was like a new thing, and my nephews and nieces were using it. But now I see it and I see the marketing and the advertising and content applications for it, and I find Snapchat to be quite enjoyable.
And the NLL apparently did as well, as they utilized it in a very unique application on Sunday.
They did. They were, one of the, you know, at the top when there's, like an event going on, or sometimes it's like sponsored. The indoor box lacrosse was one of them, and the NLL took it over, and it was pretty cool. They had a lot of different angles from like a mammoth game, and quite cool. Good content, and I was sort of didn't expect that to see that there. Terry, back to the games. Albany and Yale played a thriller. I have some thoughts on this. I know you do as well. After two Blaze Reardon saves to begin overtime, Seth Oakes buried a ground ball shot inside the right post from Connor Fields as the Albany Great Danes earn their first top five win since 2014, taking down Yale on the road 14-13. It was Albany's seventh straight victory.
Both teams are now 10-2 and flip-flopped spots in the – well, not really flip-flopped. I'm sorry. Yale fell to number 6 in the Cascade Maverick media poll, and Albany rose to number 5. And for me, what this does in terms of implications – and we can talk a little bit more about the game in a second, but I know your point is primarily relates to implications as well, so we'll start there. I, for the majority of the season, had felt like there was a top 4 – in terms of quality, with Maryland being the fifth, who I felt like, because of their losses to Notre Dame and Yale, were likely a step behind in terms of the quality of the team, but were included in that top echelon on the basis of consistency and their resume. And I feel like after Maryland beat Albany at home on a midweek game earlier this month, that was kind of supported, that Albany was probably pretty solidly sixth, leading the group of teams that, depending on the week, stretch from 7 to 15 that all had very similar resumes and potentially were similar teams, and their biggest problem was that they just had lost some games that they shouldn't have lost. Albany didn't really fall into that group. You know, their only losses now are to Syracuse in their opening game of the season and the Maryland loss that I had just mentioned. And now I feel like there's a pretty solid top six. You don't feel that way.
Terry, I'm going to ask you a question. What do Prince's music catalog and the Albany Great Danes have in common?
They're both purple.
They're both overrated.
My answer is so much better than yours.
Very good on your feet. I got to give you some props for that. But I just don't get it. I'm not seeing how they are a top five team. They're the number four RPI. They've won 10 games, Albany, and their best win is over Yale. And then that also calls into question, look at Yale's, besides Yale's win over Maryland, it's not overwhelming. Albany has only won 4 of their 10 games are against teams that have winning records. Before the Yale game, their best win was over Stony Brook. A solid team, but not in at-large contention for a bid. I don't get it. I don't think that they're... I see how they've moved up to number 5 in their rankings based on other people losing and some other movement, but they're not even close to being the number 5 team in the country.
Okay, yeah. Fringe
of the top 10, maybe, but...
You're saying this from a resume standpoint or from a eyeball test standpoint? Or both?
Both.
Okay, so I feel like this season Albany was going to suffer from people believing if they were going to be good, as good as they have been.
It's not mine.
But let me finish. That people were going to, and I'm not saying that this applies to you. I just felt like because they didn't have Lyle Thompson, it was going to be hard to believe that they were as good as they were last year. Their biggest swing function in terms of their personnel was how Seth Oakes was going to play. We didn't know whether or not Seth Oakes was going to be on this team in the fall. Connor Fields, I think, at this time last year, I was firmly of the opinion that this kid is not a lefty finisher. He is a quarterback. And I think that even though at times so far this season he hasn't totally met the incredibly lofty expectations that I had for him. I thought he was going to be like a second team All-American this year, and he might still end up being that, but he's got a long way to go before he can prove it. The thing that they had two things going for them that are a little bit more difficult to pinpoint. The first is, I really like their defensive personnel. Stone Sims is he's a sophomore defenseman. He's among the best under the radar type players in the country. James Burdett, they had another guy who I thought was a solid on-ball defenseman. That, you know, corresponds with Blaze Reardon, who, in my opinion, was always going to be a 50 to 55% save percentage guy in net. But you were okay with that because he brought so many other things to the table from an emotional standpoint, from an outside-of-the-crease standpoint. Well, here he is. He's at 59%. I mentioned earlier the conversation about first-team All-Americans. I'm back on the Blaze train as far as that goes. I mean, it's a legitimate argument at this point because he does still bring all of that stuff as it relates to transition, their clearing game, picking off passes, and he is clearly such an emotional component of this, or he's such a huge component of this team's emotional center. But the last thing I'll say is that they've got so many middies, you know, just when you look at their scoring charts at this point, they have 4 attackmen leading the way, Bennett Drake, is kind of that attackman that runs out of the box.
Great name.
Yes. But then they've got this group of middies, John Maloney, Eli Lazda, Kyle McClancy, Adam Osika, Sean Eccles, and Derek Eccles. Those guys are the prototypical Albany two-way athlete guys. John Maloney specifically is the one that I think is just so, so good and so, so tough and so, so just brings so much to the table. And so building around that core, even if, you know, that's 9 guys, right? That's 9 offensive players, a couple of whom you rely on as your short 60 middies as well. That's not a huge core. But ultimately, like, and maybe that's Albany's Achilles heel going forward. But to me, if you believe that Connor Fields is a star offensive player, Blaze is a star goalie, I don't know. I mean, I understand that they don't have the star power that some of their opponents do, but to me, there aren't a lot of holes on this team. depth is probably the biggest concern. Their ability to win faceoffs consistently is the second biggest concern. But as it relates to their resume, I mean, they have a 16-4 win over UMass, who beat North Carolina, and they have
UMass is 4-8.
A 13-9 win over, I'm sorry, a 10-9 win over Harvard, who is going to be the fourth seed in the Ivy League tournament. I'm not disputing it. My point is, or my argument is, oh, also the 12-8 win over Cornell, who is not very good. But again, all of these things amount to the question, are you asking about the eye test or are you asking about the resume?
I think I've spoken a little bit of both.
Okay. And I just don't agree with your point of view.
Yeah, again, I don't know that I'm convinced they're not an NCAA team or an at-large team, which right now they're getting, if they lose in the American East tournament, they're getting in the tournament.
For sure.
I don't believe that they...
You don't think it should be a foregone conclusion?
Yeah, I just don't get... I'm just looking at who they beat and who their schedule. I'm just not a believer.
Well, then count yourself among those who don't understand... Not don't understand. There's a lot of people that are just... They look at the RPI and they're like, how is this what the RPI says? And that was the point that I made, the first bracketology post that I did. In order for Carolina, Virginia, and Duke, not and Syracuse, not to occupy the top, you know, four of the top seven or eight spots, somebody has to. And it has a cumulative effect of raising all of those boats, particularly among the teams that don't traditionally play ACC teams. So I think that the cascading effect, the domino effect, the shakeout on the backside of that, particularly because Maryland is the number one RPI team and Albany played them, that's been the offshoot. I don't fully understand the RPI myself in terms of how it changes on a week-to-week basis and how everything kind of falls as it relates to if one conference struggles untraditionally.
Does the RPI take into account your future games?
No.
So only the teams that you've played?
Yes.
So conceivably, they have Siena and UMBC left on their schedule. They should win both of those. But they do not. It'll actually bring their RPI down.
More likely than not, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Again, I don't want to. I hate to hate, but I'm just not getting it. Like they're the number five team, and I by default is the way I would put it. But their RPI it boggles my mind.
Siena and UMBC are combined 7-17. That will be added to the second column of the RPI, which is your opponent's record, and accounts for 50% of the overall value upon which it's based. So it will bring it down, but not substantially because it'll have such a small impact on their opponent's total, right?
So let's talk about Yale a little bit. So is there such a thing as a reverse trap game there? So the game after you play a big game, for instance, last week Maryland beats Army.
And then, Navy beats Army and then has to play
Maryland. And a couple days later, it's just tough to get up for that one.
Is that called a letdown game?
I guess.
So, yeah, I think that there is such a thing as a reverse track game.
Yeah, so did Brett, you think Yale experienced that a little bit? Or do you think Albany is that good?
Well,
you're playing at home. You just had the biggest game of the season at Brown a week before.
You lost, so you presume it was a good week of practice and they were focused. Because it's not as if Albany...
Tough loss, though.
It's not as if Albany coming to town was not a good team. Like, that's a team that gets your attention. Maybe not to the degree that the Brown game did the week before, but certainly... You know, in the wake of a loss, you would assume that they weren't sleeping on Albany, and that's why I don't want to invest too much in this outcome as it relates to the pure win and the pure loss. First of all, the game went to overtime, so by definition, it was essentially a coin flip. I mean, they were equal teams for 60 minutes, and then you account for whatever home field advantage means in our sport, and give Albany a little bit of a bump as a result of that. The biggest, again...
It was in New Haven.
So, you give Albany a bump, given the fact that they won the road.
Gotcha.
So, for me, the biggest thing is, did Yale lose its best or second best player? Their implications, again, I'm shifting away from the game and more toward the implications, like, Michael Quinn, senior defenseman, first-team All-American level player, left the game with an apparent knee injury, didn't happen due to contact... I don't know. Scary situation to be in. I feel like I like Yale's other two close defensemen well enough to the degree that, you know, I don't think this is going to be a season-ruining type of injury. But on the other hand, it certainly isn't a comfortable place to be in as you head into the Ivy League tournament.
Terry, let's move on. While the Albany-Yale game surprised me by the final outcome, and I thought Yale would win that one, the game that may have shocked me the most all weekend was Duke 16, Marquette 1.
I feel exactly the same way.
And our Peter Katrampas was there to cover that one as well.
Like the saying says, when it rains, it pours. It was a close game, at least for the first 8 minutes and 36 seconds, or that much time remaining in the first quarter, as Duke and Marquette together played here at Koskinen Stadium, tied 1-1 up to that point in the game. And then after that, a 15-goal scoring barrage by the Blue Devils took over and finished the game, shutting out the Golden Eagles for the final 3 quarters plus of the game. Justin Gooderding finished with a hat trick and 3 assists, along with Jack Bruckner, who scored 4 goals as part of a 10-player goal-scoring barrage that just overtook the Golden Eagles. 9 caused turnovers by the Duke defense put together one of the best performances of the season, including 6 saves each from goalkeepers Danny Fowler and Luke Aaron. Duke now moves to 9-6 in their overall record and prepares for the ACC tournament, a key win tonight here at home on senior night that sends those like Miles Jones, Deemer Class, and Case Mathias off with a great feeling, knowing that they played well and formidably in their final game at Koskinen Stadium.
So on a scale of 1 to 4, 4 being stunned, I asked my Twitter followers on Friday evening, how surprised were you by the score? Duke 16, Marquette 1. And 22% said least surprised. They were a 1. 44% said most surprised. So clearly, Dan, my Twitter followers feel the same way about this result as yours do, or as you and I do. But the thing is, if you try to parse it out, I don't know which side of the ball surprises me more. This is a Marquette defense that came in as the hallmark of Joe Amplo's program and has been a top 5 defense each of the last 2 seasons. And Duke rang him up for 16, and it was kind of, certainly Justin Gooderding had a great day, but it was kind of without that type of star-level performance. It wasn't as if, Deemer had the 7-goal day he had against Syracuse, and it wasn't as if Miles put up 10 points. Like, this was a relatively well-rounded offensive attack out of the Blue Devils, and certainly they had, John Pendergast scoring his first goal of his career. They had guys contributing late in kind of a, hey, everybody jump into the party type of thing. But then on the flip side, this is a Duke team that's allowed 17 goals combined in its last 3 games against Notre Dame, Virginia, and Marquette. This was a Duke defense that I think a lot of people had questions about heading into, heading into the season, but even more so at the depths of this season. So I think in Quinn's top 20, he mentioned how much it seems like Duke has benefited from playing 1 game per week, having 5 practices per week, being able to focus on the defensive deficiencies that reared their heads against opponents like Richmond and Air Force. And I guess my question for you is, how comfortable do you feel about what Duke has done and the product they're putting forward as it relates to, is this a Duke team that's peaking at the end of the season yet again?
It certainly looks that way. And again, this weekend should be very interesting. They get another crack at Notre Dame in the semifinals of the ACC tournament. But I love that the balanced scoring. I think Duke is at its best when Deemer Class and Miles Jones do not have to carry the load. And when their attack gets going, Jack Bruckner had 4 goals. Gooderding had 3 goals and 3 assists. They're tough. They're tough. I mean, we know they're top-level guys. Their first midfield attack are studs. But again, it'll be depth, and we'll see how that plays in this weekend. If they win against Notre Dame, they'll have to come back and play the winner of North Carolina and Syracuse on Sunday. But it also has something, their lack of depth that we've talked about a lot this season. Obviously, they're getting rest during the week. Looking at their schedule, they were playing a lot. They were one of those teams that plays a lot of midweek games up until March 26th, and basically they started playing every weekend after that, and that's coincided with a resurgence, really.
Absolutely. And I think that it's not, it would be dismissive to say that it's not intentional. And that's why there was always going to be a little bit of red herring aspect to the fact that Duke lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament to Ohio State last year. I think that for many folks, and I will count myself among this, it took the shine off the apple as it relates to Duke as a team that likes to lose at the beginning of the season and they like to win late in the year. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people would sign up. A lot of teams would sign up for that. And it doesn't mean that you get to just do it without, you know, just do it willy-nilly without the effort and the work that goes into being able to do that year after year. And it's hard. It's hard to, you know, do all of the difficult things to put yourself in a position to get better late in the season. The shooting practice, the extra hours, taking shots to make sure that your shooting percentage jumps by almost 10 points, which it has over the course of this season. The different types of attention to detail necessary, the mental acuity that you need to show up to practice with in order to be able to handle second and third slides so that six, seven, eight guys know what the goal is and run the repetitions so that it's clear that everybody's on the same page and that that's what shows up on game day. You know, we've said it many times, John Donofsky's staff has an unique ability, maybe not uncanny, but if not, then it's certainly unique ability to manage all of those obstacles and challenges. And at this point, the equity that's been earned, I feel like you're foolish not to buy in. And so I'm with you. I think, you know, I actually think that Duke could lose their first round ACC tournament matchup, beat Boston University, and it wouldn't impact my feeling about how dangerous they are heading into the NCAA tournament.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to hating on Albany, but as opposed to Albany, like, they have a strong, they've lost six games, but they have some good wins, and they're an at-large team. And you're right, they could lose to Notre Dame in first round and still easily get an at-large berth and maybe even a home game. I think they're a strong team and they're someone not to be taken lightly in the NCAA tournament. Okay, moving on. Your Loyola Greyhounds defeated Army 12-6. Senior night at the Ridley Athletic Complex.
It was actually freshman night.
And the Greyhounds played arguably their best game of the season, beating Army West Point 12-6 to earn the number 2 seed and a bye into the Patriot League tournament semifinals. Loyola built the victory over the Black Knights on an 8-goal drive from the second and third quarters, led by the honored senior, Zach Harewires.
What a unique season it's been for Loyola. So you beat Virginia Hopkins to open your year. You're 2-0. You're climbing the polls. I don't think very many people expected them to win either, if not both of those games. And then after that, you kind of, you know, middling win over Lafayette to end February, 2-0 loss to Towson, 1-goal win at Holy Cross, really kind of dismantled by Duke. And this is a Duke team that, you know, I made the comment on the podcast at the time that Loyola has been the unfortunate beneficiary of playing Duke at the end of their spring break. But this was a Duke team that still had a couple more losses in them, and then turn around and lose a 1-goal, very disappointing loss in, you know, tough conditions at Navy. Well, then you win 6 in a row, and now they're 10-3, and I feel like they're good. I mean, the reason I made that quip about freshman night is that Patrick Spencer has continued to be talismanic offensively. He's a 23-goal, 34-assist point producer to date, and I also feel like at the other end of the field, Jacob Stover has emerged as an answer in net. And this is a team that, you know, at points last year you thought Grant Lamone was the guy. Well, Stover, I believe this was his 8th start, and he's over 60%. I did my freshman rankings last week. Couldn't include Stover, couldn't include Timmy Troutner because both of them had been non-full-time starters, Troutner due to injury. But, you know, I do this 3 times over the year, early season, mid-season, and late season. And if both of them play the rest of the way and continue to put up good numbers, then, you know, I'll include both of them at the end of the year when I revisit. but had Pat Spencer number one, and have had a couple conversations about whether or not Pat Spencer is a first-team All-American type player, which is really high praise, obviously. But these were serious conversations, and then a couple conversations about where his freshman season falls in kind of the pantheon of great offensive players from freshman seasons. I mean, you know, if Loyola plays two more games and he sticks to his six-point-per-game average, he's going to have 69 points heading into the NCAA tournament. You know, 75 points for a freshman is no slouch, and if that's what he puts up, you know, we're talking about a really special player.
Yeah, I think in Flint's article, he listed the comparisons of freshman point seasons. And
I think Spencer's third right now.
Yeah, it's a list of who's list.
The names of players that he's in front of is pretty impressive. It includes the likes of Lyle Thompson and Robinell.
Yeah, and it's obviously Loyola's doing it against a very competitive schedule too. So very impressive from young Master Spencer. Terry, let's go to the week ahead. Two conference tournaments get underway, the ACC in Atlanta, which we talked about a little bit, and the Patriot League. And the Patriot League has an interesting format. So two teams will get byes. It'll be Navy and
Loyola. That was what that game was for. The winner of Loyola-Army ended up with the second seed.
And
so moving on, the third seed is Bucknell. So essentially by losing Bucknell, it would have been a three-way tie. By losing, Army loses the tiebreaker to Bucknell. Bucknell gets the third seed. Army gets the fourth seed. Both of those teams host Tuesday quarterfinals, and Army hosts the fifth-seeded Lehigh Mountain Hawks, and the sixth-seed Holy Cross Crusaders head to Bucknell, head to Lewisburg, Pennsylvania.
How about the Holy Cross Crusaders?
Yeah, unbelievable game against Boston University. It was, you know, a unique circumstance given that the Terriers were playing without their coach after he was ejected post-game a week prior against Loyola. It was interesting when you looked at the precipice that BU sat on. If they could, you know, win that game, get into the sixth spot, they really had a miracle season left in front of them. They would have been 9-5 with Duke then on the back half of their Patriot League tournament. Now it feels like, you know, any type of postseason hope is a long shot for the Terriers, given that they finished outside of the top six in the Patriot League. That being said, Holy Cross, great crowd, a lot of energy, and a historic night for Judd Lattimore's program as they make the Patriot League tournament for the first time ever.
Yeah, check out the video on the Epic IL Game Day recap. It's one of the games we cover, and you can see the crowd and the excitement and the joy in the players' faces as they sort of storm the field and celebrate with their goalie. It's a really cool scene, and you can check that out on InsideLacrosse.com. Down in Atlanta, Terry, man, there's some heavy games, and really the most important game is the sort of the
showcase game.
The showcase game between Brown and Virginia, which we've talked about a little bit. But I'd love to get your fresh take on it the game's 4 days away.
So hard to believe that Virginia built momentum coming away from a one goal win over a team in Georgetown that was 2-11 prior. That being said, it feels that way. Certainly with the way that the game unfolded, you know how dramatic of back and forth an affair it was. Felt like both teams went toe to toe. Kevin Warren said post game that he thought his team played one of its best games of the year. So you wonder now, with Brown coming off of an absolute dismantling of Cornell, you know, after having won a midweek game last week, I've said it time and again, I wonder where Brown's motivation to win this game is going to be. And certainly when you consider the stakes for Virginia, win and you're kind of back in the conversation, losing your season's over. All I'm saying, just something to keep an eye on. I promise you this. When I do a bracketology post, whether it's next Sunday or Monday or Tuesday of the following week, if Virginia has a win over Brown, you're going to be surprised by how well their resume stacks up to the rest of the bubble teams.
Yeah, Virginia will have wins over Johns Hopkins, who is like in the top 10 in the RPI. They'll have a win over Penn, which is a solid win. They'll have a win over Brown, which will be is number one in the RPI right now. So they will have some very quality wins for their 8-7 record.
Right now, Virginia is 22 in the RPI, and I expect that if they were to beat Brown, they would rise to probably 16.
Yeah, and looking at Virginia's resume, they lost a High Point. Hurts. One goal lost a High Point back on February 23rd.
High Point's 23 in the RPI, so it doesn't hurt.
And I would say the loss to Cornell hurts.
That hurts a little bit more.
Yeah, March 12th lost to Cornell.
Cornell's 28th in the RPI. I'm telling you, when you put it all on paper, they don't have a loss outside of the top 30. They're going to be in the mix, man. It's crazy.
I'm rooting for them. I'll see them
just for the chaos?
Yeah, it makes things interesting. Although Brown is just unbelievable.
Well,
I love watching them. Talk about not having a letdown after your big win. They went and just steamrolled Providence 16-10.
Another team with a sneaky great defense.
And then unleashed the Browns. So they're there against Cornell 22-5. Man, that's just a beating.
Again, and that's the thing that I would say about how you approach. You feel like a team that with such a high-flying offense would approach a quote-unquote meaningless late-season game, it almost feels like they could win without putting their foot on the gas. And those are teams that I would be concerned about. You know, if it were Maryland in that situation, you wonder if, all right, well, you know, a dominating Maryland performance means that Maryland's winning 6-2 in the fourth quarter. Well, all of a sudden, you string together two or three goals. It's a completely different game. You know, with Brown, if they just kind of keep it in third or fourth gear and build a 7 or 8 goal lead into the third quarter, and then Virginia can string together a few goals and it's not going to make a difference.
So Brown, getting back to their showdown with Virginia, will be on Saturday. So the semifinals take place on
Friday. On ESPNU, yep.
And then Virginia is the odd man out of the ACC 5-member league and will play Brown on Saturday night. But Brown also has to play Dartmouth on midweek game, home game, 7 o'clock night game. That is for they've won a share of the Ivy League championship.
They will host.
And they can clinch it and go undefeated in the Ivy League, which as someone I've worked in an Ivy League school, you win an Ivy League championship, that's really what you play for. And this is a big deal for them, go undefeated in the Ivy League. Midweek game, maybe you do rest your guys a little bit over the weekend. Have a nice little trip down to Atlanta.
Maybe. I don't know.
We'll see. Is that game on TV?
No.
Land of the cover of darkness. Oh, man. Oh, it's going to be interesting to see, Terry. Terry, it's time to move on. Wait a second. Talking about games coming up this weekend. Got to check the Cascade Maverick IL Game Day Center. Terry, we forgot a key game. The greatest, and I mean the greatest rivalry in all of college lacrosse. Homewood Field, this Saturday afternoon, 2 o'clock. The Maryland Terrapins will invade.
You already said Homewood Field.
I know.
You're really painting yourself into the corner there, bud.
I didn't know how to get out of that one.
I'll just drop a clown noise like sound.
Tickets?
Yeah, you think it's going to sell out?
Yeah, they put out a notice last week. So not even the Monday or Tuesday of the game week, but last week. I just got a message from Hopkins saying, look, if you want to go to this game, get your tickets now. It's going to sell out. There's nothing like it. It's I know Army-Navy is a great game every year, and it's a great rivalry. But lately, let's say the last 40 years, the stakes haven't been the same as usually when Hopkins and Maryland get together. Maryland, in a lot of people's minds, they're the number one RPI team. They could be the number one team in the country, depending on how the votes shake out. Hopkins needs this. It's now a Big Ten conference game as well. This is going to be fun.
You mentioned that Maryland could be a number one team, depending on how the votes shake out. Quint is the lone voter who voted the Terrapins number one. Do you think he did that so that his alma mater could get a number one win?
Because
I don't. I don't think he cares about that at all.
I don't think so either. I think that what's important to him is being truthful and putting out what he thinks it should be and putting his opinion out there. But I'm really excited for this game. I can't decide whether I'm going to drag my family over there. My 4-month-old, am I going to take Bennett to his first Hopkins lacrosse game? His first trip to Homewood Field. It's a momentous occasion.
Yeah, it's a father's choice, man. Well, given that I'm not going to have to deal with parking and walking, I say you have to do it. That being said, we all know
strollers. We actually got you don't have to throw the kid in the stroller.
Perfect. There you go. I think you just need the weather for yourself.
I need the weather to be right. I don't know what the weather is supposed to be.
Well, I think as of right now, it's going to be good.
So excited. 2 o'clock starts. Perfect time.
So, what do you think is going to happen? How do you think the game's going to unfold?
Fortunately, I really think Maryland is going to.
You know how I made that comment about how impressed I am with sometimes these top 10 matchups having a consistent kind of bent to them? Hopkins plays Maryland tough, man.
I know.
They've won this game when they should not have several times in the last 6 years.
That's what I'm hanging my hopes on. I see this. You think it'll be a low-scoring game?
No. I feel like Maryland's going to try to run a little bit on Hopkins. I thought they did that a little bit against Navy, and I think that there's a similar reason to why you would want to do that if you're Maryland. I think that the biggest difference between this and the Maryland-Navy game is that I feel like Maryland thinks Hopkins is going to be able to score a little bit in the 6-on-6. I think that the reason they wanted to run on Navy was not only because they thought that they would be successful in doing so, but also because they felt like if they were successful, they'd be able to build what I would call kind of an insurmountable lead. Against Hopkins, I think you do it for the inverse reason, which is if they can be a little bit efficient, and particularly if Ryan Brown gets hot, starts putting up big numbers on Kyle Burnlaw, then it's a different beast that you have to deal with. I don't expect either team to have a significant advantage in terms of the faceoffs. Like, you know, if it deviated beyond 60-40 either direction, I'd be surprised. So I think the possession is going to be pretty equivalent. And I expect a 12-10 game. I feel like Hopkins is going to win. I feel like Hopkins is going to win 12-10.
I feel like I wish Joel Tinney was playing this week.
I feel like Maryland fans wish that Matt Neufeld was playing this week.
I'll take Joel Tinney in that matchup. Terry, I got a question for you. Remember when the NCAA selection for basketball was about to happen? And there was a whole camp of like the Syracuse guys where it was like, those games when Boeheim wasn't coaching shouldn't count. Do you think that has any translation or any similarities for Hopkins' resume as it relates to Petro missing those games? You know, Hopkins has only lost 2 games since February. They're 8-2, or excuse me, 7-2 since February, and their only 2 losses were on the road during Petromala's
absence
for medical reasons. And they were both close. Oh, well. The Virginia game was a 1-goal game. The Rutgers game, 16-9. But is that a factor or no?
I think that they should count because technically he – I mean, I think – I think
that they count, of course. But is it when it's on the offense kind of thing?
Oh, okay. I thought you were asking the question as to like how this compares to his – like his march toward 300 – or is it 200 or 300 wins? He's moving toward a career milestone. Yeah, so yeah. I'm sorry, I misinterpreted the question. I thought you were asking whether or not I thought the wins should have counted towards career win total. So you're asking whether or not...
Would a selection committee...
Take into account his absence?
Yes.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Whether or not they should... Well, you know what? This gets back to a conversation we had last week. I feel less confident in my ability to predict the behavior of this selection committee than I have in previous seasons. If I were on the committee, I would not take a coach's absence into account as it relates to comparing teams, because even though that's a very highly notable, that is something that can have a very notable impact on a team, I don't think it's so much more impactful than a lot of the stuff that goes on that you wouldn't be aware of. So it feels like you would be giving favor to a team only because you knew of their circumstances, whereas other teams might have been dealing with something similar, but you just weren't aware of it. That would be my reason for not awarding a team for not punishing a team as severely for losing in their coach's absence.
Yeah, so that's my point. I'm not asking to be rewarded, but I'm wondering whether they would hold it against them or not. In that this team's resume versus this team's resume, well, there was a little bit of a reason for this, possibly. Although I would say that Coach Benson and Coach Blanc did a fantastic job in his absence, but it's not the same as happening
there. Sure, and I think that it's not even a function of what he brings to the table, but I also think you have to account for what his absence does to everybody else that's surrounding him. I mean, it's hard to focus if you are concerned about your coach's physical health. So I do think that it's impactful. I just don't think that it's something that a committee could take into account.
Gotcha. Terry, it's time for new words to live by.
Well, we're talking about coaches, Dan. This is something that, we got off on a certain kind of foot so far with this podcast this week. And like you mentioned, it was a somber tone. And my thoughts went that direction. So I think that listeners of this podcast wouldn't be surprised to hear that, I identify as somebody who's kind of a put your head down, go to work type of person. And in 2012, I came across a video of then Marquette basketball coach Buzz Williams talking after the, I believe it was round of 32 NCAA tournament win over Eastern Kentucky. That feels right.
Sounds right.
In any case, there was a lot about his monologue that resonated with me. It was about 7 minutes long, and the whole video has been since taken down. But portions of it remain, and I'll play them here now.
A country kid that just hung in there. Hang in there, hang in there, hang in there. Throw good pitch, throw good pitch. The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. Show up and go to work. And do it every day, no matter what's surrounding you. You got to be a lion chaser.
The part of that that really resonates with me is show up and go to work and do it every day, no matter what's surrounding you. And I think it's a lesson that I try to live by all the time. I think it's a reminder that I kind of needed this morning. And I think that it also pertains to where we are in this college lacrosse season. For 20 teams, your season's over. You have one game left, hopefully, but you've been eliminated from conference, your conference tournament. Obviously, that manifests itself in many different ways. For the remaining 50 teams, you've still got hope. You show up and go to work, even if you're the fourth seed, even if you're the sixth seed in your conference tournament. There's nothing else to do but show up and go to work and do it every day, no matter what the surroundings are around you. And it's the only way that miracle runs start. So thanks for listening to the podcast. We hope you enjoyed it, and we will catch you next week.
Enjoy the game.
Inside the Cross Podcast.